Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with stateside super producer, Kiefer. That's right, Kiefer, who recently won a Grammy for his work with Anderson .Paak. He's work with everyone from Drake to Moses Sumney to Theo Crocker. And what we get in this chat today is a real insight into the kind of the tastes of a producer that's worked covers, not just kind of somebody aforementioned, but you know, he's more than just a beat maker. He's, you know, he's a jazz pianist, and we really go in on the influence of jazz on him as well. It's a really wonderful chat. It's done remotely. He's at home in San Diego, and I think we touch on that. Do you know what? I think I actually was referencing the fact that there was no hurricane. There was just some rain, and I went, "Oh, that's good stuff." And as I finished that sentence, I thought, did he just think I meant good stuff that there's been they were warned of a hurricane? I hope not. That was the start. But we got stuck into a wonderful chat about music and a really unique upbringing. You know, being exposed to maybe a lot of music that I guess maybe a lot of, you know, other kids his age weren't being introduced to. And I find them kind of sort of things really interesting as to, you know, parents that are really educating their kids on music and the intricacies of it, to then, you know, it then becomes a focal point for them, and it becomes, you know, something that becomes a career, you know, a career option, and then an actual career. I think that's really interesting, and we touch on that, and we really delve into this a kind of era that I've never really spoke about much on here. And it's that kind of period between sort of 2002, 2003 to the late sort of 2000s, and it's an interesting little thing that we discuss. That's about halfway through. Anyway, I'm telling you what we're chatting about. You're here for the chat, so I'll speed things up. This is the point, you know, where I tell you that if it's your first time listening, then you should go and check out the back catalogue at the end of today's episode. If you like hip-hop, then go check out my chats with Chuck D, Yellow Wolf. If you like your producers, I've spoke to? Blimey. Fatboy Slim, Butch Vig, you know, did he produce much? I'm not sure. Nevermind by Nirvana, Smashing Pumpkins, Sonic Youth, you know, nothing massive. Who else have I had on? Heaven 17, who produced and put together, you know, the big comeback for Tina Turner with Let's Stay Together. Had a great chat with them. I'm sure I'm missing other producers that I've had on the podcast. I do apologise. And I've also had some incredible bands on, from the Foo Fighters to Motley Crue, some amazing actors from David Duchovny through to Maxine Peake. And comedians. Well, I've had a real who's who of comedy greats. So go check the back catalogue out when you finish today's episode with Kiefer. I'd ask you to support the podcast in a couple of really easy ways. Most importantly, just give us a like, love, share on the socials. Tell your friends about the podcast. That's really good. And if you really want to be a big supporter, then if you can spare $1 a month, I think that converts to about 70p. you get to become a Patreon. And not only is it just a gesture to support the podcast, you get access to hundreds of radio shows. You get access to many, many, many never released recordings. You get access to watch the podcast. I put the videos up over there so you can go and watch all the episodes. And you also get invited to the monthly live show, which is something you can do. It's done over Zoom, so wherever you are in the world, you can just jump on. You can have your camera off and your mic off and just, you know, listen in, or you can get stuck in and it's your opportunity to feature on the podcast. I've been banging on about my Patreon for months and months and years, I guess, now, as we've, you know, we're over 500 episodes in now. And if you haven't tried it, then it's only $1, 1 month, and you can unsubscribe if you want after a month. You can get on there, enjoy that month, absolutely rinse the back catalogue, and then unsubscribe, and you've got all of that for $1. But hopefully you'll see the value in it, you'll enjoy the live show, and you'll be a long-term supporter of the podcast. You can find out about that and anything else you need to know, all the social bits that I mentioned, at Off The Beat and Track. It's not beaten. Off The Beat and Track podcast.com. Okay. Just a few thank yous before we get on. Big thanks to Scroobius Pip and everyone at the Distraction Pieces. Big thanks to the Blue Murder Club podcast, wonderful true crime podcast. The team over there produced this, so go check them out. Give them a like, a love, and a share on the socials as well. It's Blue Murder Club. And I guess that's it. We just get on with the real good bit now. So please enjoy Off The Beat and Track podcast with the delightful Kiefer.
It's Off The Beat and Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Kiefer, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Where are you today? Where are you recording from?
I'm recording in at my parents' house, actually. I'm visiting my family. I was just at a wedding yesterday. So, yeah, just at my childhood home.
Where's that?
In San Diego.
San Diego. Oh, lovely. All right. I take it. I mean, by the looks of the wind, you've got nice sunshine there, right?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Usually we do. It's like 70 degrees or 70 degrees and sunny all year long. But we actually had a hurricane warning for the first time ever.
Oh, wow.
Yesterday. And then it ended up just being a normal rainy day.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh, that's good news.
Okay.
Right. Well, look, let's jump straight into your playlist today. And I always ask guests first to tell me the song that they regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Well, you know, I don't know what has the greatest ever intro, but I have my favorite. One of my favorites is True Master. This is a song by Pete Rock. And the thing I love about this intro is he's mixed together like all these different samples of James Brown and some other people, and it's got to be like four or five different voices that he's making go back and forth until the beat comes in. I just think it's amazing.
It's an absolute cracker. And I guess that kind of sort of mashup of samples and obviously James Brown and he has been so prevalent in hip hop over the years and sampled to death. But I think Pete Rock, he just takes it to different levels, right?
Oh yeah, certainly. James Brown's incredibly important. You know, without James Brown, you don't have funk. You don't have, and then without that, you don't have disco. And without that, you certainly don't have hip hop. So James Brown's one of the most important musicians of the 60s, in my opinion. He's as important as every other major luminary from that decade. So,
absolutely. Kiefer, I'm going to ask you to put your producer hat on for a moment. And I want to ask you essentially about the intro. And when you're working for, I guess, more sort of commercial, big selling artists as a producer, we're seeing the way that the way that young people are consuming their music now is, you know, and it is important now, it feels, to have presence on TikTok with your music and to get on certain Spotify playlists. And these all seem to be driven a lot around a kind of dwindling in size of attention span and just hook them, grab them quick and pull them in. Tell me if you think I'm wrong. But in regards to sort of, you know, when you're working with these huge artists, do any of these kind of trends in how people are getting their music filter through into your creative process around the intro as a producer? Do you follow where I'm going with the question?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've certainly noticed this trend that you're talking about. That's certainly, you know, a symptom of the social media era. I feel like with the music I make, I'm not too concerned with those things for better or for worse. And I think when people work with me, they know that's not really something I would be too concerned about. If it happens, that's great. If I do have a catchy intro, if the team does come up with a catchy intro, that's cool. But I guess that's not a principle for me. But I do recognize what you're talking about. I for one reason or another, have not been too concerned with that.
But I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to that, Kiefer. I think, you know, I have people that come in here, and if we you know, just use the Pete Rock example as a, you know, because the actual beat don't drop for maybe 30, 40 seconds. And you know, you look at some of these classic intros, whether they be Pink Floyd, whether they be Sympathy for the Devil or whatever, like these are huge intros before you even get a vocal. And I think in this day and age, I guess with more commercial music, record companies would be like, whoa, what's going on here? This is way too much. Like, but I think, you know, with other genres, I do think there's obviously space for that. But I do think in the commercial market, you know, when you're targeting that younger audience, I do think it is there. And I think that's a shame, because I do think in some ways the art is being compromised. You're not going to get another Bohemian Rhapsody, or you're not going to get, you know, these huge songs that take ages to actually, you know, get where they're, you know, before the beat drops and before the vocal comes in. I think all of these classics that we look towards, they were never being judged like that. And I think nowadays they are. And I think that kind of hindrance or that kind of thing to become a more commercial pop success, I think that's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's, I don't know. Although I will say, I think, you know, another symptom of the algorithm is that I think we also might overrate that this is the only stuff that's happening, is the quick, the stuff that's maybe for people with shorter attention spans in any given moment. I think also, yeah, just because of that, there's this other effect of like, we're not realizing that there is a lot of stuff that is successful that probably has more, the long songs and more intricate arrangements and things like that. Those exist as well. We just might have to look a little harder.
Absolutely. Yeah. Please tell me the first song you remember hearing, Kiefer, that had an emotional impact on you, please.
Yes. When I was a kid, my dad played a lot of John Coltrane and Miles Davis and stuff like that. And so one of my first memories is the song Blue Train by John Coltrane. I just remember the intro is, that's another song with the fantastic intro. You know, maybe, you know, that intro is super iconic. I feel like, when I was a kid, my dad used to make me recite the names of the performers on this. He had a, you know, various records, and he would play Miles Davis and ask me who it was, and he'd play John Coltrane and ask me who it was, Oscar Peterson, Sonny Clark, people like that. And so I remember this was the first one that I could get right. I recognized the Blue Train intro instantly every time. And
being brought up on jazz, I guess for a lot of young kids of your age was probably a little rare, you know, to be educated on jazz. When it gets to the point that you're at school and your friends are kind of listening to hip hop and stuff, could you pick the samples? You must have had an encyclopedic brain of going, well, that's Coltrane, that's Miles.
You would think so. I mean, I
when you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I didn't get into hip hop until a little later.
Right.
I liked, when I was like maybe 12, 13, I started getting into like, I loved Outkast and I loved, you know, Jay-Z and stuff like that. But a lot of those weren't sampling like jazz sure. records per se. They're doing a lot more soul records and things like that. So I didn't necessarily know, all, you know, those samples. I don't know. I don't think it happened until a little later, yeah. But, would have been nice, I guess. But I thought that that music was just what everyone listened to. Like yeah. when I was like, you know, 8, 9, 10, I remember like, you know, I remember thinking like, everyone knows who John Coltrane is. Everyone knows who Miles Davis was. I was shocked to learn that my friends didn't know who those people were. But yeah, I don't know.
That's yeah. a great education to have at 7, 8 years of age, you know, being introduced, oh, yeah. you know, to, I mean, that's heavy music for little ears, isn't it? And, What an education. So you mentioned San Diego earlier, and that's where you grew up, yeah?
Right.
Kind of fond memories of growing up in San Diego. And tell us a little bit more about how musical home was. Obviously, you've alluded to the fact that your dad was playing your records. Was there instruments in the house? Was that encouraged?
Yeah, definitely. Very fond memories of growing up in San Diego. It's a beach town. You can see the ocean from my parents' house. You know what I'm saying? It was really nice growing up here. Lots of time spent outdoors. We weren't allowed to have video games or anything. So we just, when we were at the beach, we were at the beach. And when we weren't, we were bored. And mom said, yeah, play some music if you're bored. Just do that, you know? So that's what I was doing. My dad plays piano every day. My mom played piano as a kid. She's pretty competent. She played like a lot of like Debussy pieces and things like that. So she knows how to read and she knew all her scales and stuff. So, my mom taught me how to read music and my dad taught me how to improvise. It was always highly encouraged to play music, especially when it became obvious that it was my favorite thing. My dad's rule was, make your favorite thing your job and do it extremely well and don't mess around with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sound advice.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, look, I guess we should talk school. Now you're sort of leaning towards, you know, what you chose to do for a career. So tell me about the song that reminds you of your time at school, please, Kiefer.
Yeah, sure. So the way I interpreted this question would have to be, I went with like stuff I listened to in high school.
Sure,
so in high school, I started getting into Slum Village. There's probably like my senior year of high school where I listened to that album, Fantastic Volume 1, if you can believe it. I think most people know Volume 2 the best, but Volume 1 I listened to like every single day in high school. And so this song is called Keep It On. That's one of my favorites from Volume 1. And a lot of people don't know that one as well as some other ones on that album, but I just absolutely love it. So I think it's like track 2 or something. So
yeah. Did you enjoy school?
I did. I actually had a pretty good time. You know, school, I didn't go to like a nice school, but it was, I had my friends. I was really good at I was really good at like finding what I liked about it. You know, I played basketball. There was some like some comedy stuff I would do like in the theater program there every so often. And then just hung out with my friends and, you know, got straight A's and got out of there.
I know obviously you said that your dad told you to, you know, do something that you enjoy. When you was at school, did it feel like music could potentially be a career?
At first, no. Yeah, I think a lot of times when we think about our careers, we think about usually two things: what we're good at, or maybe three things: what we're good at, you know, what we love to do, and then what makes money. And ideally, you want to do some, you know, if you can get all three, that's pretty great, especially if it serves the world. And so I think, first I was more concerned with like what I was good at. I thought what I was good at should have been the thing. And I think at that age, maybe 14, 15, when I started high school, I thought that I was good at math and science and things like that. So I thought I was going to be an engineer because both my parents are engineers. They're both aerospace engineers, or they were. And so they're retired now. And so I thought I was going to do that. And then I think by junior year, that's like my third year of high school, that's when I realized I think I'm just going to do this music thing because it's just, you know, it's just taking over.
And was it encouraged at school?
I'm sorry?
Was it encouraged at school?
Oh, I wouldn't say it was discouraged, but they didn't. I'm the only professional musician out of my high school that I know of. Maybe really? One other. I'm not sure. And it was a huge high school, like 2,000 kids. I mean, San Diego, I love San Diego, but it's not, I don't know, not a big music scene here. It's, you know, it's quite small. Yeah. Very, very small. Of all the cities in America, for the size of it, it probably has the smallest music scene for how big it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you for track four to tell me the first song you remember buying from a record store, please.
Yeah. The first album I ever bought with my own money, went to Tower Records and I bought the Outkast double album, which I believe came out in 2003, this speaker box / The Love Below.
Kiefer, this is ridiculous. Yeah. This is ridiculous, mate. It's like your first record's meant to be absolutely embarrassing. It's meant to be the one that you're absolutely trying not to tell anyone about. And you've got a stone cold, kick-ass cool classic for your first purchase, mate.
Dude, I was fortunate. I mean, there's some other stuff in that era that was, you know, not the best, but I don't want to throw anyone under the bus, but no, this record was I'm proud of, but I will say I still was listening to it with an 11-year-old's mind. You know, I missed out on some really cool stuff. I missed out. There's like drum and bass stuff in there that's insane that I would skip over because I was like, what is this? You know. The song Prototype, I didn't notice till years later, is like one of the best written songs, period.
Yeah.
That's like an incredibly well-written song. But I just liked it because the music video was on MTV every single day. It was the Roses video and the Hey Ya video, but especially the Roses video. I love that video.
Yeah.
Obviously the piano intro was what I really loved. And I used to play it all the time. I played it like every single day. But yeah, I think now today, Prototype is my favorite song off that record. But at that time, I would just skip over that one. I didn't get it.
And it's just an absolute masterpiece of a record. And I think it should be viewed, you know, alongside you, what's going on and your Pet Sounds as concept, as classic concept albums, because it is, and 3 Feet Iron Rising, it's just got this, it goes everywhere. You can't pinpoint, you can't just say that's a hip hop record. It's all over the place. There's so many styles on that record. I think it's an absolute work of genius. I really do.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, there's trap on there. There's like songs, like R&B songs. Mm. There's neo soul stuff. Again, there's drum and bass. I forget, which one am I thinking of? Whatever. There's a drum and bass track.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
On there, that's like totally cracked out. My favorite things.
Yeah.
I think it's my favorite things.
But they were messing with that on Bombs Over Baghdad crazy. As well, weren't they? Because that was sure. Pretty much leaning towards that kind of drum and bass.
That's true.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. Amazing record. Yeah. Well, let's talk record stores. And I know you're of a generation where I guess vinyl was disappearing in your kind of more formative years as at college and stuff like that. So tell me about your relationship with you mentioned Tower Records there, with the record store, and tell me about it now. If you're out and about and you see a vintage record store or whatever, and we're seeing the resurgence of vinyl, is it something that excites you and pulls you in?
Oh yeah, certainly. I have slowed down on buying vinyl just because it's so expensive. I was just like, and I'm an addictive personality, and I was just like, oh my God, I can't be doing, hundreds of dollars a week. I got to slow down. But I love playing records at the house. It's one of the best things you can do for a party. Just say have records and play them. It's such an amazing thing. Going to a record store is that's a very inspiring thing. I think the idea of a record store for me is it's somewhere to go to find something that you didn't know was going to be there.
Yeah.
I grew up in like the iTunes era. Mm. So that would be like when I was like 10 or 11 until I was like out of high school, that would have been like 2003 to like 2010. That's like when iTunes was like the thing. Yeah. And the problem with iTunes was that, and MTV was also the thing at that time as well. And with those two outlets, you would just see what was on the front page.
Yeah.
Like the iTunes store, you just see there's like six things there. And it was like U2, Norah Jones, Jack Johnson, John Mayer, not dissing anybody, Lenny Kravitz, not dissing anybody, John Legend. But that was it. It was like there was like eight things would go on the iTunes front page and they would choose it. It wasn't based on like, and then at some point they'd figure out what you were buying and they'd start putting up stuff like that. But then it would still be like, it was so curated. And then same thing with MTV. It's just whatever's on TRL, it would be the top 10 videos. And so, when I was in high school, like I do think that was kind of a cultural low point for America because everyone was listening to like the same 10 things. And yeah. I think that's where we get that like super, super watered down pop music of the era. Mm. From like 2005 to 2012, 13 was like just fucking everything was the same all the time.
Absolutely.
And so going to record stores is kind of the antithesis to that. I didn't really get into that until a little bit later, but I understand what it's like to not be given a lot of musical options to listen to. And so when I go to a record store, it's great to just feel that that there's a lot more stuff that I don't know about, and it's great.
I've done sort of 500 plus episodes of this podcast now, and I've never really kind of got into that generation that you've just mentioned there. And as soon as you were saying sort of 2003 and kind of everything post that started to get a little bit watered down in the sort of commercial sort of front of things, do you think that was a kind of the record companies waking up to realize that they'd fucked up by sleeping on Napster, and it was like, right, okay, whatever we've got now, we can't get it wrong. We've just got to go as generic and as safe as possible. Do you think that come in the wake of sort of Napster? And obviously it's quite well documented that major labels slept on that and missed it. And you know.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, you know, companies need money, and yeah. When they aren't making any, then they're going to start making sacrifices. And I think one of the first sacrifices a record company would make is creativity, right? Isn't that the main thing they sacrifice?
Yeah. I mean, that sentence is so fucked in itself, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what they would do.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what they do. Mm. They're not in the business of creativity. They're in the business of business. They're trying to make money, you know, you know. They're not the artists. They're just trying to make money. Hopefully, yeah. Making money for the artists if they can. But I think that might be the case. I think, the music industry was not doing well in the 2000s. Yeah. When physicals went out, there was just it was a dog eat dog world out there, and only so many artists could really make it. That's something I think about now too. I think one of the things that gets lost in the social media era, I think. Or the streaming era, rather, you know, a lot of people are bemoaning the fact that Spotify isn't paying out too well. And that's true. But don't forget that in the early 2000s, people were trying to give away their CDs on street corners and couldn't even do that, you know? Yeah. So I think there is something to be said for people getting to listen to your music for virtually free when you start out. I don't think it's ideal. But I think there is something to that, because again, we were still trying to give away our music for free.
Sure.
For like throughout the 2000s, there were people who were making mixtapes and CDs and trying to give them away for free, and no one was picking them up. I remember, like, do you remember that? There's people with CDs everywhere. Hey, you know, trying to hand them over.
Absolutely.
Hand them on the corner. And so I don't know. It's a different era now than it was. I think in the 2000s it was just like it was so cutthroat. I wasn't a musician at that time, but. I don't envy the people that are making it happen at that time. Yeah,
I think people were experimenting. I mean, you look at you mentioned U2 on the front of iTunes. I mean, U2 gave their record away, didn't they? You woke up. I don't know if you remember that, and the new U2 record was automatically on your iPhone, and it was like,
right.
that caused a. You know, but I think a lot of people were pissed at that. It's like, man, I don't want a U2 record. It's like, you know, you've presumed it and you've just thrust it upon my device. And I think it's an amazing, right. Amazing bit of marketing. And obviously U2 have right. always been pretty on the money for moving with trends. And I think
right.
that was quite interesting. I don't know if you recall as well. I think in the probably about 2007, 2008, Radiohead done an option where you could just pay
in rainbows,
you want.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, just pay what you want. And I thought, I mean, I guess it's easier for Radiohead to do that than it is an unsigned artist that's desperately trying right. to pay his bills. I guess if you've got Radiohead money in the bank, it makes it a lot easier to kind of experiment with the, you know, the different ways. But I do think, you know, it's a really interesting time for the music industry and what come out of that, because Radiohead haven't given an album away since, and thankfully I've not had a U2 record in the last 10 years pop up on my phone that I haven't asked for. if they wanted to stick Joshua Tree on there, I would have been all over that, but it weren't that one. Okay, right. I'm gonna move forward a little bit and ask you to tell me about a song that soundtracked your years clubbing.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, you know, it's funny. I never went clubbing. I was never. I never did that. I think I might have gone to a club, like a real club, like maybe like twice in my life. I was talking to some of my musician friends about this recently, like my roommates in college, they're also music majors. Like, we didn't go out for real. I mean, like, we would just make music at the house. And I think I gave up my social life to just like practice and practice. You know, I was transcribing Herbie and stuff. You know,
I mean,
so I feel like it's a cop out answer, but
not at all.
Herbie Hancock when everyone else is at the club.
I mentioned to you, Kiefer, I've done 500 of these, and I'd say 80% of every songwriter or musician or producer I've had on this podcast has pretty much echoed what you said. Didn't really go clubbing. I was too busy creating, and so you're in good company there, and yeah, I mean, sitting there trying to transcribe Herbie Hancock records. I mean,
yeah,
you ain't going to do that in a couple of hours and then go out. There's some serious graft's got to go into that, right?
Yeah, I wasn't that talented. No, I was spending many hours trying to figure it out, you know. Yeah, one of the most important ones, his solo on Witch Hunt, was actually off a Wayne Shorter record. That I remember spending a lot of time doing that one. Dolphin Dance as well. Yeah, lots of different Herbie, so many different Herbie solos. Yeah.
So I'm intrigued at that kind of level of focus, you know, and sacrifice to go, look, you know, I'm not going to go out with my boys and go clubbing. This is what I want. Tell me about your relationship with drive and how driven you are, because, you know, you've carved out a career in one of the most cutthroat industries, and you've achieved great success in that, and you're sustaining that and that's not easy. So tell me about how driven you are.
Well, thanks. I think for me at that age specifically, and it carries through to now, there was an identity change at some point. I remember, I think I was like 19, and I saw one of my favorite pianists play. His name is Gerald Clayton. I saw Gerald Clayton play, and I thought, like, what's the difference between me and this guy? You know, like, what's really the difference? And I thought, well, one of the differences is that, you know, well, I don't practice as much as him. And when I don't practice, I don't really care. You know, like when I was 19, I didn't care if I practiced or not. Like if I missed a day, I was like, okay with that. And I was like, I feel like he wouldn't even tolerate that or even really think about it. And I think the difference was, if you asked me at that age what I'm doing with my life, I would say, oh, I'm a student. I'm a student at UCLA and, you know, might do music, you know, you know, thinking about it, you know. Whereas if you asked Gerald Clayton what he's doing, he would say, I'm a pianist. And there's a difference between I'm doing music and I am a musician. And then I just started thinking that way. I said, I need to start thinking of myself as a musician. And if someone were to ever ask me that question, the answer should be, I am a musician. Yeah. And then rather quickly, whenever I wouldn't practice, I wouldn't feel good, because it didn't line up with my personal identity. I'm like, oh, that's not me. Like I didn't practice today. That's not good. You know, that's not unacceptable, yeah. You know? So it wasn't so much drive. I mean, it does take drive for sure. But I think even more fundamental than that is just, believing in the identity that you aspire to have. That's what I say. If you believe that you can be and believe that you are the identity you aspire to have, then you'll start behaving in that way. Whenever I wouldn't, it was like, it became like brushing my teeth. It was like, I can't go to bed without brushing my teeth. That's disgusting. You know, like, you know, if I didn't practice, it was like, this isn't right. This isn't good. I need, you know. It just became an identity change where it's like something I just like had to do. And then everything started changing really, really quickly.
That's fantastic. Okay. Let's take you home. Favorite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Okay, I'm going to have to go with my buddy Heather. So Heather is a friend of mine. I was actually his roommate for 4 years, and he happens to be from San Diego as well. He's doing big things right now in the indie world. He just got off tour, or rather he's still on tour with Dominic Fike opening for him. And I just saw him a few weeks ago at the Greek Theater here in LA. Did two nights there, 5,000 people, crazy. Anyway, really proud of him. And he's just like one of the most outstanding sound designers in the world. Like his sound palette's like really insane. It's like Mac DeMarco mixed with Nick Hakim.
There's some Beck in there. There's some Beck in there, I'm telling you.
Beck, Brian Wilson, George Harrison. He's into so many different things. This song, one of my all-time favorites, this is a song that is called When You Loved Me.
Fantastic. Yeah. What a record that is.
Yeah.
So how was that? You kind of studied together then. So you kind of watched each other's trajectory as well.
Yeah, we moved in together in 2016, as cheesy as this sounds, we moved in together literally to chase our dreams. I think that was, again, as cheesy as that might sound, I think we literally said that. It was like, let's figure this out. Let's move in together. Let's like work really hard and let's motivate each other. And we did exactly that. It was music all day from 9 a.m. to 1 a.m. every day, just all day long going hard. Both rooms, my room and his room, just hear the beat all day long. Fantastic. Yeah, extremely inspired time with him.
Oh, superb. Okay, Well, this is your last track, and this is where you get to be tastemaker or influencers, I believe they're called these days. Can you tell me, please, Keith, for a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to go and listen to?
Yes, this is a song that I think most people wouldn't know. I think if you were a crate digger or a hip hop head, you might know this one. This is called "Holding You, Loving You" by Don Blackman. Don Blackman was an incredible pianist, arranger, vocalist, songwriter. He played in Parliament for a short time, and then this is the only record that he put out that I know of. There might be like a few other ones that are out of print that I might not know about, but this record's absolutely insane. Dennis Chambers is on drums. It's just like some of the coolest shit ever. Yeah.
How did you discover it?
I found this because of my buddy Mind Design, who's a producer on Stone's Throw. And then also Jay Dilla sampled it. So I think that's probably how he found out about it. So Jay Dilla sampled it on a Slum Village record. So I already knew the song, and then he showed me the sample, and then I was like, that's where that came from, you know? Shout out Mind Design for that.
Fantastic. Well, look, we've been talking about everybody else's music. Let's talk about yours. What's happening?
Oh, well, you know, I've got a new album coming out in about a month. Let's see. And September 22nd is the day. It's called It's Okay Be You. And then I'm going on a tour shortly thereafter. So I'm just preparing for that.
Fantastic. Where's the tour going to take you? Across the States?
Yes, we're doing a U.S. tour first, doing 17 cities. And then we're going to go do UK and Europe and Asia thereafter.
Fantastic. If people want to check out the new record and want to find out about dates, where's the best place to keep up this things all Kiefer?
Well, you can follow me on Instagram. That's kind of my main hub. My handle is Keef Daddy Supreme, which is very silly. But I think if you look up Kiefer, you should be able to find me. K-I-E-F-E-R. You can also go on my website, kiefermusic.com.
Fantastic. Well, if it's cool with you, Kiefer, we'll tag you in this post when it comes out. So they listen to this podcast. If they're not following you already, then they can go and do that and find out when they can come and see you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, oh, really, mate, appreciate it. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to press stop. Don't go anywhere. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. That was Kiefer. Oh, delightful human being. Wonderful taste in music. Really interested in kind of like stumbling across that conversation as to, so why did that happen in the mid-2000s? And maybe it was the fallout of Napster and labels just reassessing and thinking, shit, we've been a bit slow on this one. Anyway, like I say, thanks ever so much for listening. Thanks to Kiefer for giving up his time. And go give him a follow on the socials if you haven't done so already. And go check the back catalogue. As mentioned at the beginning, if you like your hip hop, go check out my chat with Chuck D. Go check out my chat with Yellow Wolf. There's been more hip hop artists on there. And I've been really lucky to have spoken to so many artists from so many genres. So why not go over there and have a little peruse and see what you can find? And you can listen to them all for free. And if I've not spoilt you enough, you can pay it back a little bit by becoming a Patreon for $1. And I'd really love it if you could do that and support the podcast that way. And you can do that over on the website, which is offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I'm back next time. In the meantime, just be nice to each other. I will see you soon. Bye-bye.